All right. So when it comes to eschatology in the scriptures, you know, everything ultimately tends to boil down to the expectations of men versus the reality of what will actually be, in the reality of what the scriptures tell us will be. And I think there's no other area of biblical study where I think we're so prone to taking little bits and pieces that the scriptures give us, little bits of information, and we reconstruct them into something, you know, often completely new and often completely imaginary. It's just a subject that lends itself to our imaginations, and that can be a good thing and that can be a dangerous thing. But this is not a new phenomenon. You know, I keep harping on the modern prophecy movement and that sort of thing, but this idea is not new at all. The ancient Jews, the Jews of the Old Testament, were quite good at this as well. And, you know, when we talk about eschatology or the study of end things, it's not a New Testament kind of thing. There is an eschatology of the Old Testament as well, although very few pay much attention to it, and very little has been written about it. But there is nevertheless an eschatological character of the Old Testament. And we've talked about this in the past, you know, but things are more difficult when approached solely from the Old Testament perspective, because in reality they were facing two advents. They were facing two comings of Christ. And you know, we talked quite a bit about this in the past. But we've noted that the Old Testament prophets had difficulty understanding the idea that Christ was going to come twice. And actually, it's not really that they had trouble understanding it or struggled with it. I think the real problem was that they just weren't aware. It wasn't like they knew it was going to happen and they couldn't figure it out. They just really weren't aware that Christ's coming was going to be in two parts. And so to them, it all seemed like one event. We call it the prophetic perspective. From their perspective, they looked ahead and all they saw was one event, that Christ would come. But this idea that they held to, that it would be one event, that's important. Their expectation is important because this is what shaped their thinking. This is what shaped their understandings. And this idea of one coming shaped their expectations about the Messiah. You know, and we often talk about the false Jewish notion that you know, the Messiah would come, and what did the Jews think that he would do? He was going to come to do what? To rule, to reign, to set up the kingdom. All these things. He was going to bring justice once and for all. And so were they wrong? Well, no, because Jesus did come to do all of those things. The problem was they lacked perspective in how this was going to play out in time, in history. So they weren't wrong in any of those expectations. They just weren't really aware of how it was going to all play out. You know, they couldn't reconcile their understanding of this kingly Messiah with, you know, what's kind of the opposite of that in the Old Testament. Where would you send somebody? Where would you send a Jewish person to see the real character of the Messiah that was to come? Isaiah, you know, and this idea of the suffering servant that was to come, and the other passages as well, but it's really laid out very clear. That just doesn't square with this notion of a king that's going to establish his rule and those sorts of things. So at the same time, we ought not assume that, you know, with the addition of the New Testament canon, that for us everything is all cleared up. You know, we've got it now. We see the whole picture. We might tend to think that that's the case, but I suspect that one day we're going to learn just how little understanding we have, and become aware of the things we haven't known, and how far off we've been in some of the things that we've kind of stuck to our guns. You know, our expectations, just like the Jews of the Old Testament. I think we're going to find out that some of our expectations might not be what they should have been. But we do have more information. There's no question about that in the New Testament. But when it comes to studying and understanding, you know, the end times, it really can get to be pretty arrogant when you think about it. Because, you know, as you get into that, you start to feel like you're unlocking all these mysteries and you're solving all these things. And I do think there's a certain arrogance that can come out of that, even though it's not intentional. You know, even in a book like Revelation, with all of the complex symbolism of the book, there is so much plain truth in Revelation, focused on the glory of Christ more than anything else, that we get so caught up in the complexity of it all that we miss the basics. And this is really what I think we're dealing with here in this passage that we're going to consider today. About, I think it's probably 40 years old or 35, 40 years old. There's a little book on the end times that was written called What Are We Waiting For? And it's not a great book. I wouldn't recommend going out and getting it. It's not terribly useful. But I love the title of it because it really captures the essence of what eschatology is. We complicate it so much, but ultimately it comes down to this question. What in the world are we waiting for? I mean, really, what is our expectation? What is our basic, hope? And I think this is a real basic question for the church, that the church has to answer. You know, because we are the future bride of Christ, we ought to have some sense of what we're waiting for. And so, you know, really, what are we waiting for? What were the Jews of the Old Testament waiting for? And, you know, I think that this is a question of expectations, and it's a pretty important question with regard to the gospel. How many people in the last, 150 years, and I'm beating up again on the prophecy movement, but, you know, how many people in the last 150 years have been converted, but rather than being discipled, are almost immediately introduced to all of this end times prophecy nonsense? They're pulled right into it. I mean, as soon as they enter the kingdom, this is what's put in front of them. And you know, it's kind of like they're saying, now you know Jesus, and the next thing that you've got to know is how to figure out, you know, all the end times things. You better know how to identify the Antichrist, you know, when he comes. And so this is sort of you get the point. And honestly, in some circles, that's not an exaggeration. It really is not. I've seen it firsthand. In fact, all too often, the prophecy stuff actually comes before the gospel. I mean, that's really what you're inundated with. And somehow out of that, there is the gospel presented as this way of escape so you don't get left behind in the secret rapture. So the gospel almost becomes a secondary thing. And again, that's not maybe a little dramatic, but I don't think it's entirely dramatic. But Jesus in the Gospels is all about interacting with folks, knowing full well that their expectations are off base. I mean, we see that over and over and over again, that people that just didn't get it. They expected one thing, and the reality is nothing like it. And Jesus is really good at engaging, fortunately for us, and for them, Jesus is very good at dealing with false expectations and how to handle people. And this includes his interactions that we see with his disciples. You know, they did not understand what he came to do, and we're familiar with that. You know, so the question is, what were they waiting for? What were his disciples' expectations? They thought they knew. They thought they knew exactly what this God-man had come to do, and it wasn't playing out that way. They see rejection where they thought there would be, you know, their fellow, you know, Jews would be bowing down in for the king, and none of this is happening. It's not rolling out the way they thought. So Jesus deals with this over and over again in the Gospels, and you know, at times he kind of takes his chisel and he reshapes their expectation very carefully, you know, not causing a lot of damage. He does this a lot with using the parables. The parables were a great tool for reshaping expectations about how things would be. And at other times, Jesus takes out his sledgehammer. And you know, we see this in the end of chapter 23 in Matthew, where Jesus tells them about the destruction of their city and their temple. I mean, that's maybe not a sledgehammer. That's maybe more like, you know, TNT or C4. He just blows everything up that they clung to. Their expectations are shattered. It leaves their minds spinning, and they start asking questions. And that's what our study is prompted by, are these questions about things that they need to know or feel they need to know. So the reality of what we see in the Olivet Discourse is that Jesus is preparing them for judgment. And that's not necessarily where they expect to go in this discussion, or perhaps where we expect this discussion to go. In the last passage of Matthew 25, we're introduced to Jesus, the Son of Man, as he's called, as the judge of all mankind. And the parables that we looked at previously stressed the need for vigilance, for preparation. You know, but why? Why that emphasis on preparation and vigilance? And there's really two sides to this. I think in the parable of the bridesmaids or the ten virgins, we have more this focus on the future. You know, that knowing that there is a wedding to take place, you know, that us is the future bride and you know, the coming of the bridegroom, there's an emphasis on being vigilant towards the future. But the second parable that we looked at, the larger parable, there's a third one in there, but the parable of the talents seemed to have more to do with what we do here and now, how we invest the resources that God has given to us, the blessings, the talents, the opportunities that he's giving to us. That there seems to be that temporal focus on this, on how we invest in the kingdom right now and grow the kingdom. But even that parable had an emphasis, if you remember the end of it, on the, you know, or at least it pointed to the a coming day of judgment. In fact, even the parable of the bridesmaids did the same thing. You know, the servant who did not invest on behalf of the master is declared to be a worthless servant, and he's cast into outer darkness. That's clearly a reference of something to come. The parable of the ten virgins also ends with you know, a similar reference, maybe not quite as graphic, but in that the parable of the virgins, we see Jesus closing the door to the wedding feast on them and saying, I never knew you, which in reality is every bit as horrific as, you know, talking about being cast into outer darkness. They're just different ways of portraying the same endpoint. So, as I said last week, we ought to take note of the fact that, or the truth, that there is a coming day, because this is important to Jesus, is what we're seeing in this. So, regardless of whatever reasons there may be for talking about, final judgment, it's clear that final judgment is an important subject to Jesus, because he talks about it in many places in the Gospels, but you know, here is a very lengthy section. So it's not something that we can gloss over. And you know, let's be honest, we don't enjoy talking about this subject. I mean, I certainly don't. I would have rather prepared a class on almost anything else than this. You know, it's, I don't know, maybe you're more comfortable, but it's not comfortable for me, because we're talking about, you know, an experience for the human race that for some, for many, perhaps even most, is going to be the greatest human tragedy that mankind has ever seen on that last day. And, you know, we use expressions out of, you know, frustration when somebody seems to get away with stuff. You know, we talk about, well, you know, one day they're going to meet their maker. And you know, those sorts of things. There's a bunch of expressions, you know, like that. But you know, if we understood even a fraction of the horror of that final day for those outside of Christ, I don't think we'd use those expressions. I don't think we could bring ourselves to do that, because we don't contemplate, you know, what this really means. And I think Christians ought to be careful about, you know, reducing, you know, the great white throne of Revelation and the judgment that comes to that down to cliches and little sayings, but we all do it. So, you know, there are some evil people in this world, some very evil people who have lived. You know, and I would pray that, and I think as Christians, we ought to pray that God would deal with them harshly right now, so that perhaps they don't face, you know, that horror at the last day. And it's hard to do. I mean, there are some people I think we would rather think about them being judged for all eternity for what they've done. But, you know, I don't think it's where our hearts ought to be on this. But as we started to discuss last week, there are many great things about that last. That last day is not all about final judgment. You know, the book of Revelation has many great things to say about the things that are going to take place on that last day, but I'm not going to talk about any of them because Jesus doesn't talk about any of them. Not that it's not important to Jesus, but in the context of the Olivet Discourse, all he talks about on that last day is final judgment. So that's what we're going to confine our discussion to. Let me read this passage one last time. You know, as we try to not only discern what Jesus is saying, but also to understand why he's saying all this. Why is this the kind of the capstone of this long discourse, you know, prompted by questions about really something else? And I believe that Jesus is telling us something about himself as the Son of Man. And as I said earlier, you know, there's something here that challenges our expectations. And this was certainly true of the Jewish disciples. Jesus is certainly questioning or challenging what they believe about this. So starting in verse 31, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep on his right, but the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." Then the righteous will answer him, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and visit you?" And the king will answer them, "Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me." Then he will say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me." Then they will also answer, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not minister to you?" Then he will answer them, saying, "Truly I say to you, as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me." And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. And this is how he ends this discourse. It's a very different place than where it started, with a couple of very logical, simple questions about what will be the signs and the time of your coming. That's all they wanted to know. But Jesus takes them somewhere very different in this. In the Old Testament, there was always an understanding or an expectation that the promised Messiah, when he came, would not only assume kingship of the world, but that he would judge the world. There was that expectation in the Old Testament. But their understanding of what this judgment would look like is very different than what we've just read in our understanding of final judgment. There was no thought of a day like this that we just read about, but there was more this idea of a balancing justice. The scales of justice would properly weighed. You know, we would call it social justice, to use a modern, you know, buzz phrase. The Messiah King would right all the wrongs in the world. Those who are oppressed and suffer for the sake of the kingdom would be lifted up, and those who did wrong would get their just punishment. That was more the Old Testament expectations, that things would just balance and things would be the way they were always supposed to be. And, you know, this would be a day when the faithful of Israel would finally get to gloat a little bit and celebrate their vindication in the world. It was a national, you know, Israel would be raised up to her rightful position that God had created her to be. So that's kind of their understanding. And during the earthly ministry of Jesus, the disciples, as I said earlier, saw how Jesus was treated, and it certainly isn't going in that direction. You know, and they begin to think about, you know, when is this day coming? When are they going to get what they deserve? You know, good or bad. So as we think about final judgment, you know, my question would be, do we tend to at times fall into this mindset that it's going to be a day when everybody gets what they deserve? And I think all too often we do tend to think that way, but hopefully not, because, you know, what we learn from the gospel of grace is that none of us even wants the slightest taste of what we deserve. That's not something that any of us ought to be wishing for. There's a different standard for that day, which, you know, on that last day, Jesus is going to relate to all of us. He's going to relate to all of mankind in some fashion. And, you know, thankfully for us, it's not based on, you know, performance or behavior, but rather it's based solely on our relationship to the Master, to use the language of this passage. And, you know, not whether or not we said a prayer at some point in our lives, that's not going to be the basis. He's not going to say, oh, when you were 8, you said the sinner's prayer, that's good. You know, on that basis, you're going to go to the right with the rest of the sheep. There's more to it than that. There's a relationship with the Master. The Master, for us to enter to the right, you know, with the sheep, the Master must know us. We must be known by the Master, and that's something more than you know, any one little event in our lives. And you know, the image of sheep is used to obviously represent God's people, and that's that even goes back to the Old Testament. God's people were you know, imagined as sheep back then. And the coming of the Son of Man with the angels here is portrayed as an event of identification. It's a day of sorting. It's a day of separating. And we really see that this is the primary activity in this passage, is a separation of people. And we see this back in Matthew chapter 13. And you may want to take some time this week and go back and look at a couple of the, you know, fairly well-known parables in chapter 13. We have the parable of the sower, where the seed falls on different ground. We're very familiar with that. But we also have the parable of the wheat and the tares. My translation calls them weeds, but it's, you know, the wheat and the weeds. Wheat and tares is just in my brain, so that's what I think of. And we're not quite as familiar with what the real significance of that is. At least my experience is I haven't heard that talked about in sermons as much as I have the seed, the sower who throws seed. But in both of these cases, and I'll talk about both of those parables a little bit, the angels are used to do much of the work. And we've noted that before. And I just think that's a kind of an impressive thing in all of this, that these angels, you know, this host of angels on that last day are critical to the entire thing. In both of these, you know, the parable and the Olivet Discourse, there's much work for them to do. In the passage we're looking at now, the angels are going to gather all mankind, all the nations before the throne. And again, there's no reason to get into trying to figure out the logistics of where this throne is going to be. And many have gone back and tried to calculate numbers of how many people would this be. You know, we know what the population of the world roughly is, but try to figure out what it's been from the beginning. And people have actually estimated numbers. And on that basis, say, well, it couldn't be somewhere on Earth, but I don't really care where it is. And I don't think we're supposed to be.
Actually, the latest estimate is around 50 billion.
50 billion? I would have thought it would be more than that. I would have thought it would be more than that. But, you know, again, I don't think Jesus wants us sidetracked with trying to figure out, you know, things like that. But, you know, the angels will gather the people together before the shepherd. And notice in our passage, it's actually the shepherd that does the sorting. It's one by one. You're a sheep, I know you, go this way. You're a goat, I don't know you, go that way. The angels aren't doing that separating, that work of judgment. In the parable of the wheat and the tares in Matthew 13, the angels are used for gathering the weeds. Remember, Jesus says we're going to leave the weeds alone until the last day. And then he calls them reapers, the angels. They're going to spring into action. And the first thing they're going to do is they're going to pull all the weeds. And they're going to bundle them. But it doesn't say that the angels throw them into the fire or are responsible for the burning. I think, you know, I think it's implied in that, you know, the master is going to be doing that. But in John chapter 10, you know, Jesus is questioned by the Jews about his identity. Because remember, that's what matters on the last day, is your identity. Are you identified as being in Christ or not? That's what it all comes down to. And in John chapter 10, some Jews question Jesus' identity. How do we recognize you? You know, and Jesus says to them, you know, that I have told you who I am, and you don't believe that. You know, talk is cheap. And perhaps even Jesus agrees with that. So he goes on to say, the works that I do in my Father's name bear witness about me. So you may not believe what I say, but what I do in the Father's name proves my identity with the Father. And that's an important thing, because I believe that translates into the Christian life. He goes on to say, but you do not believe because you are not part of my flock. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. And this last statement's important. You know, the sheep hearing his voice, we're familiar with that. But let's not gloss over the fact that Jesus says the proof of his identification with the Father is ultimately found in his obedience to the Father. As I said, I think this principle carries over into the Christian life. The proof is not of who we are is not going to be on that last day what we have confessed. In fact, we're told many people will profess all kinds of things and point to their confessions on those last day, and he's going to say, depart from me, I never knew you. What we see in this passage is that what identifies us positively on that last day is how our profession of faith is expressed in obedience. So is that works righteousness? Not even in the tiniest little way. And if you walk away thinking that, I've done a terrible job. You know, fruit bearing is the marker of who we are and what we are. It's all through the New Testament. Fruit is the favorite, you know, image, the favorite metaphor for this. And in just a few chapters after John 10, when Jesus says what I just read, John is going to quote Jesus saying that the proof of our love for him. How do we know that we are in him? John says, actually Jesus says, being quoted, that the proof of that is what? Our keeping his commandments. And we also learn in that passage that is only possible because of the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. Even that keeping of his commandments is the work of God himself. And in John 10, you know, Jesus doesn't complain about, you know, some of those sheep who hear his voice and they're known by him, but they just won't follow. You know, I've got these sheep and they hear me, they know me, but they just won't do what they're told to do. He doesn't talk about that. He doesn't complain about that, and because that's not a possible situation. You know, sheep do listen to their shepherd. And we're not talking about, you know, trained dogs that with perfect obedience at every moment and those sorts of things. But at the end of the day, the sheep will do what the shepherd wants them to do. And, you know, in this picture, you know, goats often live amongst sheep during the day in the fields. You know, they don't look all that different than sheep, and they do the same kind of grazing during the day. But at the end of the day, they don't listen to the shepherd. Goats aren't herded that way. They won't respond. They have no identification with their shepherd. They don't obey. So one of the things that Jesus is preparing the disciples for here is that, you know, in this life, in this ministry that they're about to embark on, which they really have no idea what that ministry is, it's not going to be cut and dried who belongs to Christ and who doesn't. And that's part of what this picture of final judgment is about, is to drill this home that it's not going to be so simple. It's not like the days of old in Judaism where your circumcision, you know, and you had these outward markers that identified you. And if you were circumcised, you know, under the law, you were a Jew. You were in. And Jesus is going to tell them that that's not the case here. It's not so cut and dried. And this is made clear back in Matthew 13, where Jesus has already given the parable of the sower. I said, you know, we know that one. And this parable gives us the picture of the gospel interacting with different types of people, and producing different responses based on the preparation of their hearts as represented by the different soil types. And in all of these cases, remember, we have the rocky soil, then we have the soil with all the thorns, and then we have the good soil. In all of those cases, there is a response to the gospel. This is a parable of preparation for ministry. This isn't a statement about all of mankind. There are some who don't fall into this parable because they're not interested in any of it. They're not receiving, you know, the seed. But the one who sows the seed, you know, in this parable is going to see a positive response to the gospel in all three cases, and maybe get excited about all three cases. But it's a parable to explain to the disciples something that they're going to experience in their ministry. And we'll also see that this is a background parable for the parable of the wheat and the tares at the end of that chapter. This is kind of a preparation for this idea that the church, the bride of Christ, is going to be a mixed body of belief and unbelief. And that's something that they need to know. They need to know, or their ministry is going to be one of total confusion for them. So the first picture is that of someone who you know, the seed falls on rocky soil. And it's a picture, we're told, that person receives the gospel, even with a measure of joy, even. But what happens in that first case? There's no conversion. There's an emotional response. You know, perhaps in modern times we would say they answered an altar call and it ended in tears and, you know, in joy and those sorts of things. But just like is often the case in our times, this is short-lived. Because this person is said to have no root in himself. You know, there's this short experience of Christianity, but this person quickly disappears. And I'm sure we have all seen those people in life that seem to grasp onto the gospel. There's a conversion experience, there's joy, there's excitement, and then a week later, they're never to be seen again. It's over. Been there, done it. I'm done. So that's a reality that the disciples are going to face, just as we have dealt with that. And they're not used to thinking about these things. They're not used to talking about conversion experiences. And they're used to, you know, if you do certain things, you're a Jew. You're identified with Messiah because you do certain things. And Jesus is saying, it's not going to work that way anymore. So in the second case in that parable, there's also the appearance of conversion. But just like the first case, there's really no regeneration of the heart. The person does not necessarily disappear from the church overnight, but rather it appears that the gospel is taking root little by little. But also, little by little, the world starts calling them back. You know, this is what the picture of the thorns is around them. The call of the world is there, and because they've not given up their love for the world, it's a powerful thing. In fact, Jesus says this leaves them vulnerable, and he calls these things the deceitful riches of the world. They're very enticing, and yes, we're all at times enticed by those things of the world. But in the regenerate heart, there is, you know, a new direction for our affection that battles against that and keeps us from being pulled in. But these people are pictured as not having had that taken place, and so the world is kind of victorious and pulling them back in. And in the end, Jesus says that such a person is proven to be what? Unfruitful. They have no fruits. The world got them. There's nothing in this life to validate their conversion. If they had been converted, there would have been fruit. And but remember that for a season, this person is going to blend in. This person's going to be part of things. Perhaps, you know, having a measure of fruit or something that appears to be fruit. But in the case of the seed growing in good soil, there's going to be fruit. But Jesus says that the fruit will vary from person to person. And we get this point out of the parable of the talents as well. You know, it may be 100-fold fruit. He says it may be 60. It may be 40. But there's fruit. And it's real fruit. The amount of fruit is not something that we need to be measuring and judging and all of that sort of thing. So it's important to Jesus that his disciples, you know, then and now, understand the situation in which they live. You know, you really see this, I think, in the new members class in our church, where there's generally a group of people largely unknown to us in any real, you know, profound way, and they're all making, at least hopefully all of them are making a credible profession of faith. I mean, that's really all we can expect from them in a new members class is to have what we would judge to be, and yes, we're called to judge such things, that their profession of faith is reasonable. We can't make, you know, infallible decisions about that, and we're not called to, but it does sound like they understand the gospel and there's some evidence in their life, and that's really as far as we can go. But, you know, there's been several cases. Some of you have been here a lot longer than me, have probably seen many, where a new member grows weary of this whole thing in about 2 weeks. You know, they go through the whole class, they're all excited. Month later, where's that person? And they're just never to be seen from again. And, you know, others hang in for a while, and perhaps they even participate in the life of the church. But, you know, they're eventually exposed for what they are. And I'm not talking about people who leave the church. I'm not saying if you leave Surfside Presbyterian Church, you expose yourself to be a hypocrite. I'm not saying that. I'm talking about people who leave here for nothing. They leave church. Not just our church. They walk away from faith and from the body of Christ. And they're out there. They're out there. And of course, you know, there are those who will join from the new members class and go on to be, you know, the fruitful people that they are because of who they are in Christ. So failure to understand this reality of the church as a mixed body of belief and unbelief, righteousness and hypocrisy, all these sorts of things. The scriptures tell us this is to be our existence. This is to be the setting in which we live out our faith. And the disciples need to learn this, because failure to understand it is dangerous. It's tempting to want to believe that every single person that worships with us is a believer. I would love to believe that every single person in this building is genuine in their faith. But we know that there are weeds in every single church. And this is just the way the gospel works. You know, the gospel is presented to everyone. And there are, as we see in the parable of the soil, there are different responses to this. And, you know, in the parable of the wheat and the tares, or weeds, you know, Jesus is the sower of the seeds. And the workers in the field are, you know, kind of appalled that the master's seed, I mean, you would think the master would have the best seed. There would be no weeds in the master's, you know, good seed. So they're kind of appalled when they see the weeds popping up. And the workers in the field ask the master, you know, what are we to do? You know, they want to go out, they want to rush out, and they want to pull all those weeds. They want to weed the field and get rid of them from the get-go. They want to spray them with Roundup. They want to get out their weed whackers and go to town on the weeds. And, you know, Jesus says, no, leave the weeds. And this is so important. He says that any attempt to purify the field will do what? It's going to hurt the wheat. He says you can't pull those weeds without hurting the wheat. And that's an interesting thing. I don't understand it completely. I mean, I can understand that, you know, when you pull stuff up, it rips up roots and soil, and that's probably the image. But as far as the spiritual profoundness of that, it's hard for me to understand all the implications of it. But Jesus says, no, leave them. Let both coexist until the time of harvest. Let them both grow up. And then he says, the master has reapers that will do this work. I don't need you to do it. I think we can safely label those reapers as angels based on all the other passages where angels are used in that capacity. So these angelic reapers go out. So there's two things that I think we learned from this. You know, do not expect a pure church, first of all. We ought to be teaching and preaching, you know, the word to the church, knowing this reality. That needs to be, you need to know your audience. And we'll talk about this in a minute. It's not the teacher's or the preacher's job to identify, you know, and target weeds by any means. But there has to be this understanding that there are weeds amongst us who need the gospel. They don't need to get pulled. They don't need Roundup. They need the gospel. And so that's part of the reason that Jesus says, you know, let them coexist. But I also think that, you know, many churches, and I've been in some, where you never hear a gospel message, a real gospel message, because you hear many good things. You hear some real deep teaching, but never the gospel. In fact, sometimes when pastors preach a gospel message to a small group of hardcore believers, they kind of feel like they just got some mush. You know, it's like, well, we knew that. You know, I think that's one of the dangers.
Preaching to the choir.
And I think some ministers believe, you know, everybody's a Christian. Let's get to the meat. And that can be a problem. Another is, you know, I think failure to understand the mixed nature of the church will shape our mission, or it will affect our mission. There are so many gospel opportunities right under our noses in this church. And I have the sense that I'm preaching to the choir. I'll admit that. We're a small ABF. I think we're an ABF that tends to value kind of digging in and some deeper things and all of that. But this church is full of opportunities. And I think one of the things that we have to learn to do is embrace this mixed nature of the church. And not be discouraged by it, or even disgusted by it. It's easy to get disgusted with the reality that there's weeds in the church, but that's an opportunity.
May I ask one question?
Well, sure.
Do you think, because you said that we have to continually give the gospel to the tares, do you think there's a possibility that they are also come to Christ through a period of time?
I see no reason not to believe that. I mean, I think that's to be our hope. And I believe that's
so
part
that's
of the...
why God said not to tear them up out of there.
Yeah, because we don't know what's going to happen 2 years from now.
That's right.
So if we pull them, if we weed them out today and cast them aside, God is saying, you know, he's sovereign over this. You don't worry about that. I'm going to worry about that. I've even got my own reapers. It's kind of... the timing of conversions and all that, it's none of our business. We're to be about preaching and teaching. There's something delicate here, though, at the same time, because, I think in this lesson, it's clear that we're not called to root these people out. We're not called to say, hey, they once made a profession of faith. And I'm not talking about public sins. We need to deal with that. Other portions of the scripture tell us to deal with that. But it's not up to us to determine whose faith is real and who's not. The leaders of the church are called to maintain the purity of teaching and preaching in the church. They're not called to maintain the purity of the church. And there's a huge...
Or to judge someone else's faith.
Right.
You don't know. The only person who knows about a person's faith is that person himself.
Right. There are, places in the scripture, though, that talk about fruit and absence of fruit. And, we would do a brother or sister a disfavor not to point out to them that your life is completely void of fruit. We don't have the power to say, this is what that means. You have no fruit. You are not a believer. That's what Jesus does. That's what Jesus will do on the last day. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So again, the leadership of the church is not called to go around and spray, spiritual Roundup on these people. And I think sometimes that's what sometimes leaders believe they are called to do that. And I think sometimes we have folks in the church that impose that on us and say, would you take care of this? Okay.
Those churches don't last for a little while.
I agree. But, and this idea of Roundup may seem like a joke, but in all honesty, that's sort of my instinct personally, is to spray the weeds. I mean, it's just who I am. And, I kind of want to root that out. And that's why this church has been great for me, because I've never been in a church that has such a mixture of people. And not just believers and unbelievers, but people in such different stages of spiritual growth. And it's really been good for me. It's a good experience to have to learn how to teach and shepherd people that are immature in the faith.
There are a lot of churches around that are just inbred. They just keep getting worse and worse.
Well, there's no new
deeper,
converts.
Deeper into the old concepts.
Yeah, there's no new converts, and so often churches have people that don't know what to do, don't know how to disciple, don't know how to work with a new convert. We forget how little, we've got these three campus outreach boys, staying with us, and I won't name anybody because I'm on tape. But it's really interesting. I mean, they've got big hearts, but I have forgotten what it's like to see somebody that knows nothing. I mean, it's a little amazing to me that they're, going out and evangelizing. But, some of them do, and some of them are new to the faith, and some of them haven't experienced Christ themselves yet. And I personally think this whole campus outreach experience is more about these kids than what they go out and do. It's very, very transformational. A lot of these kids have no church experience. They've gone to college. They've got hooked up with this group, and this group is real faithful about the gospel, and they're learning the gospel, and that's wonderful. But when they graduate, they've got nothing under their feet. And we've had some really interesting discussions just about church and what it is and why you need it and why what you believe makes a difference. I mean, it's amazing. I don't know how I got off on that. But this picture that we have here goes further in that, we learn that final judgment is ultimately the role of the Son of Man. The reapers in Matthew 13, as I said, they gather wheat, but they're not told to burn them. In Matthew 25, the angels gather all people from all nations for judgment, but they're not the judges. It's the shepherd alone who either recognizes this person as a sheep or not. And I'll end with this, but the picture here is, as we talked about last week, is not simply an accounting of good works. That's not what we need to walk away from this. It's even though we talk a lot about fruits and those sorts of things, what matters in this picture is being recognized by Christ, being known by Christ. You know, because those who are in Christ, they're credited, if you read this passage carefully and you listen, they're credited for righteous works that are not their own. There's also a humility in this passage. As you notice, those who are being credited, they're called righteous. Jesus calls them righteous, and they're being credited for all these works. What is their reaction? You know, they're not patting themselves on the back. They're going, when did we do any of that? You know, and they're being credited for something that they didn't even realize that they did. And, you know, the goats, on the other hand, they also protest. But we see what's happening in their case is they're being called out for having no fruit, when, in fact, they may have been busy doing all kinds of things. And Jesus says, you've done nothing because you didn't do it to the least of these. And I think that the real significance here is that they may have fed the poor, but they did not do it as unto Christ. And, you know, they do not recognize that all service is unto Christ. The, you know, the smallest act done for the glory of Christ and unto Christ is greater than the biggest endeavor we can imagine that's done for recognition or maybe even some other things that seem really good. There's only one type of work, one type of fruit that matters, and that's the fruit that is unto Christ. And that's the this is not about performance, you know, as we measure performance, but it's about valuing the honor and the glory of Christ. And if that is our motivation, if that's what shapes us, you know, if we are sheep, it'll not only matter to us, but it's going to give us the desire to be obedient. It's going to give us the desire to express our faith. So hopefully that's clear. I almost finished.